This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.
President Emmanuel Macron has appointed a chief Brexit negotiator.
Protests in Tel Aviv gathered for a fifth consecutive night on Thursday as demonstrators insisted on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu negotiating a ceasefire agreement that would secure the safe return of the remaining 101 Hamas hostages. The death last week of six hostages after nearly 11 months in captivity sparked a wave of protests with around 500,000 people taking to the streets in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv on Sunday night. Protests continued into Monday with a general strike to pressure Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports a new indictment in the U.S. against alleged Russian military cyber criminals who launched the Whispergate attack of 2022.
The FBI special agent in charge of Maryland, where some computer systems were used to launch the cyber attack in Ukraine just weeks before the war in 2022.
These six criminals aim to cripple Ukraine's government and critical infrastructure by targeting their finances, agriculture, healthcare, and schools.
The FBI's Bill DeBagno says the Whispergate attack in 2022 could be considered the first shot in Russia's war against Ukraine.
Through strokes on a keyboard, these criminals crossed over borders.
Some U.S. companies were unknowingly involved, so the Justice Department is offering a $60 million reward to help find the suspects. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And this is VOA News. Police in Denver, suburb of Aurora, say a Venezuelan street gang with a small presence in the city has not taken over a rundown apartment complex. The allegation has gained steam among conservatives and was amplified by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who said Wednesday Venezuelans were taking over the whole town. An unsubstantiated allegation gained momentum following last month's dissemination of video from a resident in the complex that showed armed men knocking on an apartment door. The city of Aurora says that the apartment buildings and two other complexes are run down due to neglect by the property manager. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on a visit to Haiti on Thursday he hoped to see an electoral council established soon to organize elections in the Caribbean nation.
Gave me an update on the important work that's being done there, and we hope to see that stood up soon because that's a critical next step in moving forward and organizing elections for next year.
Blinken's visit comes as Haiti continues to battle violent gangs that have taken over much of the capital. Started moving into nearby regions, Haiti's prime minister on Wednesday expanded a state of emergency to cover the entire nation. Kenyan police officers who are part of a UN-backed security mission began arriving in Haiti in June. The United States secured the release of dozens of political prisoners in Nicaragua Thursday, including religious people, students, and human rights defenders, following talks with the government of President Daniel Ortega. Among those freed on Thursday were Nicaraguans associated with the Texas-based evangelical group Mountain Gateway.
Entre los prisioneros liberados.
Senior U.S. diplomat for Western Hemisphere Affairs Eric Jacobson says among released prisoners there are 13 people affiliated with the religious organization Mountain Gateway, as well as Catholic lay people, students, journalists, human rights defenders, farmers, and others. Nicaraguan authorities wrongfully imprisoned these men and women with unfunded charges just because they use their fundamental liberties. The White House announced that 135 prisoners were freed from jail on humanitarian grounds, adding that they will go to Guatemala before possibly moving on to the United States as well as other nations. Pope Francis wrapped up his visit to Indonesia on Friday after celebrating Mass before an overflow crowd of 100,000. Final celebration before heading to Papua New Guinea for the second leg of his 11-day journey through Southeast Asia and Oceania. 87-year-old Pope had no official event Friday beyond a farewell ceremony in the six-hour flight to Port Moresby. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan gender activists demand action against femicide following the death of a runner, Rebecca Cheptegei.
In Kenya, we have a law protection against gender-based violence. There's no specific law against femicide. And this is one of the things we were rallying women representatives in Kenya during the demonstrations we had earlier this year.
The China-Africa Cooperation Summit Forum concludes today, Friday, as leader Xi Jinping pledges more than $50 billion in financing for Africa. The Zimbabwe Teachers Union supports a school head convicted of misusing a program for vulnerable students. Botswana police and protesters clash over a failed bill.
Today was a momentous day in that the evil Constitution Amendment Bill, which sought to, you know, clothe the president with enormous powers, died today.
And Kamala Harris bets on stricter gun laws while Donald Trump pledges to roll back restrictions. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The people of Kenya, Uganda, and the world at large are mourning the shocking death of long-distance runner Rebecca Cheptegei. She died Thursday at a hospital in Kenya days after her boyfriend pour gasoline over her and lit it. The incident has highlighted the debate about gender-based violence in Kenya and femicide, or intentional killing motivated by gender. Gender and social justice activist Sheila Scribes of Kenya tells me that she hopes authorities will hold Cheptegei's partner accountable as a lesson for other men who might be tempted to commit a similar act of violence.
It's so unfortunate that at this time and age, we still have femicide cases in Kenya, and more so for our athletes. No matter what Rebecca did, no matter what the alleged boyfriend wanted, nothing justifies what he did to Rebecca. It's so sad that we've lost Rebecca, a young athlete who was so talented, had a lot to conquer ahead of her. But because of someone who was perhaps jealous, couldn't move on, or had his own agenda, decided to pour petrol on her and lit a fire on her. And she was burnt beyond 70% degrees, which caused her death. It's so unfortunate. It's so wrong. And I hope the man will be held accountable so that it's a lesson to other men who are planning or have done the same thing in this country. We cannot be struggling to protect ourselves against men who do not want us to prosper. We've seen cases where we have so many men who are scared or afraid of women who are becoming successful, and especially those ones who do not want to move on.
The entire incident stems from a dispute. This has got people to talk about gender-based violence in Kenya. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes, gender-based violence in Kenya is so rampant. In the research or survey that was done by Kenya Demographic Survey, it indicated that 32% of women have undergone gender-based violence from their spouses. And this is for the year 2022. I'm thinking it must be higher this year, 2024. And it's so unfortunate that we are still having gender-based violence, because at this age, where two grown-ups can be able to talk and discuss issues, we shouldn't be talking about GBV, honestly. We'd rather say, I do not need you, just go on. But because we are so selfish, we don't want to lose and we don't want to be seen as the weaker person, we end up causing trouble.
Sheila, thank you so much again. Before I let you go, what is the law in Kenya against femicide? Is there a particular law to protect women against this type of violence?
In Kenya, we have a law that was enacted in 2015, protection against gender-based violence. There's no specific law against femicide. And this is one of the things we were rallying women representatives in Kenya during the demonstrations we had earlier this year, to be able to bring a law to parliament against femicide or review the protection against domestic violence and add some clauses against femicide in Kenya. So I think that's actually one of the reasons why we are seeing many of these cases continue, because we do not have a specific law that is against femicide.
Sheila Scribes is a Kenyan gender and social justice activist. She was speaking with us from Nairobi. Botswana police clashed with protesters outside the National Assembly on Wednesday as members of parliament voted on a bill that would have given the president sweeping powers to appoint civil servants to key positions. Opposition legislators walked out while the remaining ruling party MPs failed to raise sufficient members to pass the bill. From Habaruni, Nkudise Dube reports.
Opposition members of parliament boycotted the voting, while protesters waving placards protested the bill outside the National Assembly. Parliament opposition party leader Ditapelo Gerabetsi says their concern is that the bill, if it had been approved, would have given too much power to the president.
Yes, today was a momentous day in that the evil bill, the evil constitution amendment bill, which sought to, you know, clothe the president with enormous powers to appoint the chief justice, to appoint the court of appeal president, to appoint the secretary of IEC, to have these huge powers. That bill died today.
Minister for State President Kabo Murwayeng blames the opposition and civil society organizations for misleading the nation on a progressive bill. He says the rejected bill contains clauses which would have improved the lives of citizens. He says, as a democratic nation, we respect the right of members to vote according to their conscience. However, it is unfortunate that this has resulted in denying citizens a constitutional bill that could have advanced their interests. We intended to incorporate provisions on health rights, the right to strike, and workers' rights into the constitution. The bill was a significant step forward. Muteo Omusha, a non-governmental organization, was behind Wednesday's protests. The organization's chairperson, Murena Munganja, says some members were hurt during clashes with the police.
Many of our activists were beaten. We have at least one that we know of who is in hospital with some injuries. We look at these events of citizens trying to express their displeasure at a certain piece of legislation and be met with this kind of violence as very unacceptable in a democracy.
Minister Murwayeng says protesters did not seek a permit to hold the demonstration as per the law. He says, if you want to protest, you seek permission and you'll be allowed to demonstrate. And don't forget that we have processes to follow in parliament. We must have trust in our processes. The proposed law was rejected a day before Botswana's parliament was dissolved as the country prepares for next month's general election. Mkondisi Dube, VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
The Zimbabwe Teachers Union is criticizing the conviction and the sentencing of a school head and his deputy for abusing the Basic Education Assistant Module Facility, a government program intended for vulnerable children. The two put their children on the list of the beneficiaries. Obert Matsarue is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He tells me that teachers' children are vulnerable because of the low salaries that their parents receive.
The Basic Education Access Module is designed to assist learners who are vulnerable. Now, a vulnerable learner is someone who's coming from a family where the family ordinarily cannot afford to pay for their learning materials, to pay for their tuition fees, to pay for the basics. So these are people who are catered for by the Basic Education Access Module. Now, the sons and daughters of the teacher are now vulnerable because the teacher is underpaid by the same government which is disbursing this BEAM facility. So our position is the sons and daughters of the teachers should all benefit from any government facility that is targeted to support vulnerable children. Government has made promises to support the learning of children of teachers, but they have not released enough funds for that facility. Now we have a situation where a teacher is teaching in a classroom where their own son or daughter is not allowed to be in the class because they cannot afford to pay for their fees. They cannot afford to buy their learning materials. So it's unacceptable to convict and sentence a teacher who is only trying to facilitate the learning of their own children so that they can teach other people's children while their own are benefiting from the same education.
If that is the case, are you saying that it is okay to commit a crime? Because if you use a property that is not intended for you, that is illegal. I'm asking this question because it seems to me that your union feels that because the government has not paid the teachers well, that it is okay to do what they did.
We have to attack the root cause of the problem. We don't deal with symptoms. We confront the system. What made the deputy head poor? Why are the children of the head desperate? We have a system that is well designed to give a token of support to vulnerable children, yet this is the same system which is creating vulnerability. So they create vulnerability in the house of the school head and then deploy the same school head to try to attend to other vulnerable children. While they are not addressing the vulnerability in the house of the same officer who is being deployed to deal with the vulnerable children. So the head would be committing a serious sin against his own children if he was going to be supporting vulnerable children in the community, yet his own vulnerable children are suffering at home, are being denied access to education.
Olbre Masarure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 6th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The China-Africa Cooperation Summit is expected to conclude today, Friday, in Beijing. Chinese leader Xi Jinping pledged on Thursday more than $50 billion in financing for Africa over the next 3 years. Xi Jinping said more than half of that will be in credit. Ken Gallagher is the professor and director of Boston University Global Development Policy Center. He tells Viewers Carol Van Dam that the biggest problem is that several African nations have now turned to private bondholders after shunning loan conditions dictated by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Their payments are through the roof. Just about as many countries have huge debt payments that go to creditors each year, basically at the same level of the 1990s when there was a major debt crisis and we had to have this HIPC initiative. In fact, many African countries right now are spending more on external debt payments than they are for education, health, and climate finance. And so not only is that really grave for the present, but it's really going to take a bite out of their future.
So you're saying what's killing them isn't the actual amount of the loan, but the interest that they have to pay back.
Yeah, the interest and the maturity. So they borrowed a lot of money and now it's coming due, and it's coming due at a very tough time when needs are so high after years of COVID and climate shocks and impacts from sanctions and war, et cetera. The region's really been battered. They need more money than ever to not only recover, but to get on a better growth path. But they've got a lot of debt, and the cost of it is increasing.
The Boston University Global Policy Center, which you lead, took a look at the numbers regarding Africa's debt to China in particular since 2007 up through this year. What does that show?
Well, overall, China is still a relatively small part of the Africa story in terms of stock. It's about 11%, the biggest external debtors for the African region. Number one are private bondholders, New York, London, et cetera. And number two are multilateral development banks like the World Bank and the African Development Bank. But China's increasingly become a larger piece of that pie, financing infrastructure, energy, and so forth, upwards of about $182 billion since 2000.
That's a huge number.
Huge amount of money, and it's had some real positive impacts, but it's also exacerbated some risks.
So when you have this size of debt, budgets, like you have mentioned, for other critical investments that can lead to jobs is slashed. How does this affect the populations in Africa trying to fight climate change or MPOX, which has, you know, come on the scene again?
Absolutely. They're less able to prevent and mitigate pandemics like COVID and MPOX. Climate change, the region's been just racked with droughts this year. Kenya, Zimbabwe, 60% of reduction in the corn crop. Really just unable to respond to these things because every dollar that they have to squeeze out of the taxes, a big chunk of it, upwards 50, 60% for many countries, has to turn around and go back to bondholders in New York and London, at China, and also places like the World Bank and the African Development Bank. The region really needs a three-pronged effort. Number one is debt relief. They just can't afford to be able to do this, and the costs of doing it the way they're doing it are their own people today, their own people tomorrow, and it also has an effect on the world economy because Africa is such a big place. When it's not growing, it's dragging down global growth. In addition to debt relief, we need new money. New money has to generate economic growth so that can turn into tax dollars that employ people, obviously, but also can pay back debts and be used for investment into education, health, and climate resilience.
Kevin Gallagher is the professor and director of Boston University's Global Development Policy Center. He was speaking with VOH Carol Van Damme. A shooting at a Georgia high school on Wednesday this week was a stark reminder that firearms killed more Americans per capita than in any other large, high-income country, according to health experts. Vice President Kamala Harris wants stricter gun regulation. Her opponent, former President Donald Trump, pledges to roll back gun restrictions. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias explains.
A shooting at the Appalachian High School in Winder, Georgia on Wednesday left several people killed and others injured. Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris reflected on the incident during a campaign stop in New Hampshire.
We have to end this epidemic of gun violence in our country once and for all. You know, it doesn't have to be this way.
The topic of gun violence in the United States featured prominently in this year's Democratic National Convention. Harris laid out her priorities on the issue early on in her campaign.
When we win in November, we are finally going to pass universal background checks, red flag laws, and an assault weapons ban.
Harris says she seeks reasonable gun safety measures and is, quote, not trying to take everybody's guns away. The president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, Chris Brown, trusts Harris will deliver. Brown was interviewed via Skype.
Candidate Harris and Vice President Harris have been very, very clear that gun violence, the number one killer of American kids, is a problem that needs a multi-level approach to solve it. We need better policy.
Former President Donald Trump reacted to the Georgia shooting with a post on his Truth social media platform. He expressed his support for the victims and called the shooter a, quote, sick and deranged monster. Conservatives often advocate for gun rights, but this year's Republican National Convention didn't prioritize the narrative. The event took place in July, just 2 days after Trump, their presidential nominee, was targeted in an assassination attempt. The experience did not change his stance on Americans' access to guns.
If you take away guns, can't do it. because people need the guns for protection.
Trump stood with gun owners when he was president and has promised to roll back restrictions enacted by the Biden administration. Pro-gun rights groups say if gun owners turn out to vote in November, they could tilt the scale to their favor in battleground states. Alan Gottlieb, executive vice president of the Second Amendment Foundation via Skype.
To take back the White House so we have an executive branch of government that isn't infringing on gun rights, and in congressional districts, strengthening gun rights in the House of Representatives and getting control of the United States Senate.
Gottlieb notes, however, that gun rights haven't historically topped the economy or immigration on the list of voters' concerns. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Uganda, where Olympic athlete Rebecca Cheptegei has died days after being doused in petrol and set on fire by a former boyfriend. The 33-year-old Ugandan marathon runner, who competed in the recent Paris Olympics, had suffered extensive burns after Sunday's attack. The authorities in northwest Kenya, where Cheptegei lived and trained, said she was targeted after returning home from church with her two daughters on Sunday. Cheptegei, from a region just across the border in Uganda, is said to have bought a plot in Trans Nzoia County and built a house to be near Kenya's elite athletics training centers. My colleague James Barty spoke with Mark Sally, spokesperson for the Ugandan National Council on Sports, on the death of the Ugandan athletes.
We understand that she was having trouble with her boyfriend or her husband, and that according to the family, she reported this to the police. How come no action was taken?
Yeah, it's a good question, that, and it's a sad tale, like I say. Unfortunately, because I'm on the Ugandan side of the border, and these incidents were happening across the border in Kenya, because her boyfriend was from Kenya, and the piece of land over which they were feuding happens to be on that side of the border in Kenya. So it was being dealt with, the matter was being dealt with in Eldoret, which is a Kenyan border town. And that is actually where she was hospitalized as well after she was attacked, unfortunately attacked by the boyfriend. So I can't speak for them across the border and why police do not do something about that. It's an unfortunate incident. I can see that happening on this side of the border as well.
And out of football, where three African players are in contention to win the 2024 men's and women's Ballon d'Or, with Nigerian international Ademola Lookman on the 30-man shortlist for the men's category. The Nigerian Atlanta forward is part of a field which include Lamine Yamal, the Barcelona winger, who only turned 17 in July, who has both Moroccan and Equatorial Guinean heritage. In the meantime, the first round of qualifiers for the CAF Africa Cup of Nations are underway. Rwanda managed to secure a valuable equalizer in their 1-1 draw against Libya. In Morocco, Comoros faced off against Gambia in another thrilling encounter, which ended 1-1 apiece. The clash between Tanzania and Ethiopia ended goalless. Burundi secured a hard-fought 3-2 away victory over Malawi at Bingu National Stadium on Thursday. In Ghana, an added-time goal from Felicio Milson gave Angola a shock 1-0 victory over Ghana in the 2025 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier in Kumasi on Thursday. There are 10 qualifiers set for Friday, with title holders the Ivory Coast and former winners the Democratic Republic of Congo, South Africa, Morocco, Egypt, Zambia, and Senegal all in action. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 6th. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning.
This is the voice of America. Washington, bam, bam.